This is KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah, 88.1 FM Fort Bragg, and KZYX.org on the World Wide Web. Stay tuned for Education Now.
Must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they fix, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and cry.
Well, hello and welcome to Education Now. My name is Athena Melville, and I'm just delighted to be with you again tonight. Education Now is being brought to you tonight by Away With Words. Away With Words editing, writing, and publicity by Catherine Hart, MA, helping businesses, writers, and individuals to say it with style. Fiction to nonfiction, press kits to novels. 9370186 or words at mcn.org. And it's also being brought to you tonight by the Greenwood Community Center, 32nd Annual Great Day in Elk, Saturday, August 26th, noon to midnight. Parade, carnival, games and food, barbecue 4 to 7:30 p.m., dancing at 8 p.m. with Blue Dot and the Kerosene Condors. Information at 877-1105. Well, welcome again to Education Now. Tonight we're going to talk about a model elementary environment, and then at about 7:20 or so, we'll take a music break, and I'll get Dr. John Melville on the line, who's going to be talking to us tonight about science and creation science, mythology, psychology, and his work with pheromones, or as I like to call it, the bliss factor. Now, we've been looking at model environments and what to look for. I want, hopefully we're empowering ourselves by looking at model environments. So what we did at first was we talked to William Crane and Alfie Cohen and Art Costa to tell us what to look for in a model environment. And then we looked at a model middle school and high school, which was School of the Woods with Betsy Coe, and that's a private school. And then we looked at a model preschool in St. Helena, which was a cooperative with Maureen Kelly. And tonight we're going to look at a model elementary from the award-winning public schools in Palo Alto, Violoni Elementary School. The area that is now called Palo Alto has been inhabited for the past 5,000 years. The Ohlone native peoples lived there before the arrival of the Spaniards in 1769. The next 100 years saw the development of the missions along the length of the California, followed by the granting of Mexico to its favored citizens. The school district was founded on March 20th, 1893. The first school opened in September with two teachers and 70 pupils. The Ohlone Elementary School is one of 11 elementary schools in the Palo Alto Unified School District. As an officially designated district alternative school rather than a neighborhood school, Ohlone serves families from throughout Palo Alto, Stanford, and Los Altos Hills, as well as families from East Palo Alto and Menlo Park, who participate in the volunteer transfer program. Attendance rates are high. Children are admitted to Ohlone via an equal access drawing or lottery, which takes place the January prior to September entrance. Once siblings and children participating in the volunteer transfer program have been accommodated, all available kindergarten spaces are filled from the equal access drawing. Parents are required to attend a principal's an orientation session prior to making a commitment to Ohlone's guiding principles and practices. Let's see, there are 24.3% of the children represent racial or ethnic minorities. Collectively, Ohlone families speak more than 21 different languages at home, in addition to English. The student-teacher ratio is 17 to 1, and it's almost 50-50 boys to girls, with the girls having a slight edge. I've been observing at Ohlone Elementary for the past 5 years, so I feel very comfortable talking about it with you. The mission statement of Ohlone Elementary School is, "The basic goal of Ohlone School is to help each child acquire the tools of learning, reading, oral and written language, mathematics, in such a way that the child experiences a joy of learning, is able to use these tools to further his or her learning, and has the desire to further his or her learning." So you see that fits right in with what Crane was telling us, and Cohen, and Dr. Costa. Now, Ohlone Elementary School is an officially designated Palo Alto Unified School District alternative school with voluntary enrollment from throughout the district. Ohlone adopted an open education approach in 1976 and has since gained wide recognition as an innovative pace-setting school. Fundamental to an Ohlone education is a set of core values which distinguish Ohlone from Palo Alto neighborhood schools. In applying these values, Ohlone focuses on the process of learning and strives to produce alumni who seek opportunities to continue learning, can develop strong positive social interactions, can make decisions and take responsibility for the resulting outcomes, are able to discover and draw on all available resources, and are well-rounded individuals. When parents are looking to choose a school, what they will discover about the Ohlone core values is trusting and respecting each individual. Mutual respect, honesty, and personal responsibility are key elements. It's a developmental approach. Each student's curriculum acknowledges the uniqueness and developmental level of that individual. There's an ongoing assessment process of observation and feedback, and it's utilized to design and recognize individual growth and change. A meaningful, relevant curriculum. Ohlone provides a training ground for real life so that each student becomes a self-directed, thinking, lifetime learner. There's multidimensional learning. Optimal learning focuses on the whole child. Social, emotional, and academic development are of equal importance. Cooperation and collaboration. Students of multiple ages work together on projects designed to help them share strengths. So there's peer teaching. They accept support and communicate ideas to one another. And there's a partnership between teachers and parents. Parents who work together to support the students and the school program. The student-faculty ratio is about 1 to 17, and the it's a small student population, about 340 students at 1 to 17, and then the grouping is K-1, kindergarten, first grade, then second and third, and then fourth and fifth. And so peer teaching is happening in class, and then as they get older, they go into the other classrooms and work and help out. Now, the reason that Palo Alto schools, really all of them, are award-winning schools. And after Proposition 13 in 1981, the population of Palo Alto and that district voted to keep their tax base and continue to fund education at the level that they had been funding it. And because of that, they can do a lot of things, of course. And lots of the, also after Proposition 13, they decided, parents all wanted different philosophies. They wanted to have different philosophies of education. And so they started these schools that were not part of the regular schools. And Ohlone was one of those. And it was based on developmental, peer teaching, experiential, all of the things that we have been talking about with Dr. Crane, with Alfie Cohen, and Art Costa, with Betsy Coe, and with Maureen Kelly. The district has a... first of all, I want to talk to you about the outdoor environment. The outdoor environment is... there's a large grassy area and play structures. There are the long classrooms with porch, covered porch, running the length of the classrooms, and with a table out from each classroom, and then cubbies where students can keep their things. It's very open. You don't feel any stress when you're on the campus. No one is approaching you, asking you about your business. There is a large library, a beautiful library, that part of the art program that they designed there is that students would make tiles, paint tiles, individual tiles, and then they would be applied to the outside of the library and also in parts of the bathrooms and some of the benches, because they had some mobiles before they got their permanent buildings, and so this was a way of giving the children a feeling that when they came back, even if they had been in these mobiles, there was some permanence there of them. And they also have a large multi-purpose room, which is outfitted with fantastic sound system, lights, so that when they do performance, it's amazing. And they also, in terms of, there's a farm on the school, and I'm going to talk to you about the farm at length. Behind the school is the farm, which is part of the school. And then that, there's a pathway then into the Friends Church behind there, which is not connected to it at all. And the Buddhist church is there too. So they can walk through there with, there's no trespass or anything. There are little paths going through. And so it's very... a very welcoming community to all of the students. The farm, continue with the outdoor environment, the farm, the history of the farm at Ohlone is come a long way from its start 20 years ago. The farm began with the dream to use the undeveloped land behind the library as a continuing science project with a host of opportunities for ongoing learning experiences by children. In the spring of 1985, a farm coordinating committee was formed to bring this dream to fruition. With the cooperation of a large number of parents, school officials, and teachers, Ohlone officially opened its farm in fall 1985. They started with a chicken coop, rabbit hutch, garden beds, fruit trees, pond, and a scarecrow. Over the years, the farm has grown and improved, fueled by small grants, donations, school district help, and lots of hard work by parents, teachers, and students. A greenhouse, several sheds, and a permanent pond were installed. The organic garden was improved with raised beds, irrigation, and paths. About 3 years ago, a new barn and paddock were added. The newest installation is the Ohlone Native Habitat, which will serve as a learning environment for the second, third grade curriculum on Ohlone Indian culture, as well as for studying pond habitat and other uses. The Harvest Festival has been held for many years as a gathering to celebrate the farm and the Ohlone community on a warm fall afternoon. In recent years, it has become the farm's most important fundraiser, And I can tell you that it's really wonderful to go there. There's live music and dancing, and you know, the animals are there, the sheep, the chickens. It's fantastic. And they do use the farm for scientific observation of organisms around the and inside the pond. They talk about plant use by the native peoples, and then one parent who's an expert on watersheds describes ways of teaching about native cultures using native plants. They teach school gardening basics there, and then they have a renewable energy panel, which they've already brought solar energy onto the Ohlone farm, and they're talking about integrating renewables into the California science curriculum. And they talk about how to get food with the children, math in the garden, recognizing garden insects. And then the Palo Alto Children's Museum demonstrate a variety of outdoor and nature programs offered by the museum as well for the children. There's a life lab with soil studies and haiku writing outdoors and establishing compost systems. So the farm is an incredible outdoor classroom. And really, because of the farm, they raise a lot of funds for the school in that fashion. Now, in terms of art, as well as what I told you about, and every teacher, of course, has her own does her own art thing. But they have a thing called Spectrum Art for K through 5, which Ohlone is a K through 5 elementary. It's district-funded elementary art program, the Spectra Art. It's sequential, standards, based art instruction, and over the entire school year. There's a wide range of media and processes. Spectra is an art-centered curriculum with a focus on developing skills and encouraging self-expression. Artist teachers rotate among the classrooms of new teachers in the first, second, and third grades, providing weekly or biweekly lessons. And then there's another program in art called Meet the Masters. It's an art heritage program, and it supports basic art curriculum for over 20 years. The docents from the community are trained by the Palo Alto Unified School District Art Education Office to deliver and meet the master's lessons. And they only go into classrooms of requesting teachers. This isn't a something you have to do kind of thing. A teacher requests it. The lessons cover art history and hands-on projects based on the work of 12 selected master artists. I told you about the art on the library, the tiles, and now drama, every year a play and sometimes a musical. And then every 5 years they do Monkey King with director Otak Jump, who wrote a score for Monkey King. And there's acting, dance, singing, and instrumental music. And then the art on the walls is integrated into the whole thing. And then they save the costumes to do it for the next 5 years. So a student gets to participate in this at least once in their life at Ohlone. The other way that drama is brought into the curriculum is they have many simulations around history, for instance. If they do the birth of the nation, then they'll take parts, and you know, you can be, maybe you're a peasant, maybe you're a slave, maybe you're a landowner, and then they take on those characters, and all day long at class, and even out onto the school grounds, and it's just fantastic what they learn in that process. Now, one or two parents in each class volunteers in the class, and the teachers will use the skills of that of each individual parent to enhance the learning environment of the school. So if the parent who volunteers is a physics person, well, then they'll bring physics into the classroom. If the person who volunteers is an art person, well, then they'll bring some art into the classroom. So that's a wonderful way that the parents are sharing their knowledge with the students. Current events are very evident in the fourth and fifth grades. The newspapers are read, discussions taken, voting. Another big event besides the Harvest Festival is the Spring Fling, and that takes part on the green. There's a stage, and once again, live music and entertainment, booths, games and food. And the children make things, and they can sell there at that event. It's quite wonderful. Now, the music, the district program for the schools is to hire teachers who travel from school to school with a music program, professional musicians. And that's one thing that they do. And then K through 1 does choir and chorus. Then second and third grade, it's song flute. And then fourth, fifth, instruments are introduced, and they have band and orchestra, wind and strings. Then by the time they do a big concert every year, and the fourth and fifth graders sing, they do jazz choir, they do band, they do orchestra and flutes, and it's just amazing and beautiful. There's lots of experiential learning, lots of field trips, and there's one particular field trip where they go to the park, Foothill Park in Palo Alto, and overnight. And Foothill Park is an amazing park in Palo Alto. You have to be a resident of Palo Alto to use the park, but there are no speedboats or anything like that. It's a beautiful, beautiful environment. Now, I'll give you contact information for the Palo Alto Unified School District and Ohlone School. I was going to do that at the end, but why don't I give that to you now? www.ohlone.pausd.org. Well, that about covers the Palo Alto Ohlone School. If you have any questions, you know you can always email me at hermes@pacific.net, and I'll get back to you. Right now, I'm going to put on some music, and then I'm going to get Dr. John Melville on the phone, who's right now at a conference in Chicago, so I'll be calling him at a hotel. So here, I'm going to put on some Dr. John. You know, Dr. John and the Lower 9/11 are coming to Fort Bragg, the Cotton Auditorium, as a benefit for KZYX and Z. You can get tickets online at kzyx.org or by calling 1-800-838-3006. It's going to be a fabulous time. So here's some Dr. John for you. Well, it's not quite ready. I have to go back. I did something wrong here. So let's try again. Oh, did it again. Well, I did it. I just keep doing it. Wrong song. I'm so sorry, everyone.
Dream when you're feeling blue. Dream, that's the thing to do. Just watch the smoke rings rise in the air. You find your share of memories there. If you day is blue. Dream, and it might come true. Things never are as bad as they seem. So dream. Dream when you are feeling blue. Dream, that's the thing to do. Just watch the smoke rings rising air. You find your share of memories there. So dream when the day is through. Dream and it might come true. Never all as bad as they seem. So
that was Dr. John. Thank you so much for that. That was wonderful music. Well, I have another Dr. John on the line. Dr. John Melville, Professor of Biology. Hello. Hello, John. Are you there?
I'm here.
Well, hello. And you're in Chicago, right?
Yes, I am currently now in Chicago. I mean, I'm in Chicago right now. I'm heading back to Wartburg College here tomorrow.
And what are you doing in Chicago?
I'm actually working with a good friend of mine, Wes Colgan, who I went to grad school with. He currently works for a company called 80 Instruments, and I'm helping train professors and teachers from all over the country on how to use a software program that they've developed.
That sounds fun.
Yeah, we were just at the University of Chicago. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Tonight, Burton on the news was talking to a gentleman from Sonoma State at Project Censored, and I thought of you. That's your alma mater, right? You got a BS and a BA at Sonoma State?
No, I got two BAs, one in psychology and one in biology.
Right. And then you went off to graduate school at Oregon State.
Yes, that is correct.
Where you got a PhD in?
Zoology.
And then you went to work at the University of Oregon in Eugene.
Yes, that's where I did my, what's called a postdoc.
Uh-huh.
So it's before you get, quote-unquote, a real job. You do a, it's basically where you do sort of a, it's kind of the equivalent to a residency doing research for several years, and I was there for 4 years.
Right. And while you were there, you were doing some work on pheromones, which we'll talk about later. And also, did you do some teaching at a JC there a little bit?
I actually taught for a brief time at Lane Community College, which is a great community college, in Eugene, Oregon, before I got the job at Wartburg College.
Right. Now, in Wartburg, at Wartburg, you get the opportunity to teach and do research.
Yes. It's Wartburg College is a small liberal arts college in the town of Waverly, Iowa. It's actually quite well-renowned within the state of Iowa, but not a lot of people have heard of it outside of there. And it has one of the longest-running undergraduate research programs that I've ever heard of. So every biology major in the department has to do some form of undergraduate research. And so that's a large part of what I do. I teach neuroscience. I teach introduction to neuroscience for non-majors. I teach in the interbiology sequence, and then I also teach research methods and then like how to do research.
Right. And now you've done some traveling too. You've been to Oxford?
Yes, I always went to Oxford briefly.
And that was connected with work that you were doing in neuroscience.
Mm-hmm.
that correct?
That is correct.
And I, one of my favorite stories, am I going to embarrass you if I tell it?
I don't know. We'll find out.
One of my favorite stories when you were there was how there was places full of biologists and you were staying at a college that had a pub in it. So you could all go there, but everyone stayed there. But you left. You went out to explore because Tolkien and Tennyson and all of these people who, you know, Oxford, and you were kind of surprised that they fit the stereotype of nerds.
Well, you've got to be a little bit kinder to my colleagues, but many of them were at that meeting to discuss specifically a field called neuroethology, and for me it was my first time to what I consider Britain to be Europe light. Everything's kind of different, but they still speak English. And so for me to be surrounded by all of that history, especially in Oxford, to be able to go where Henry VIII had been, to just see so many amazing things, in addition to, Tolkien having, you know, grown up right around there, having worked right there, in addition to everything else, and even the history and science that's there, it was just too amazing not to go around, not to explore, and not to see. I think several of the other people that I had been there with, they had already been, you know, to Europe. They'd seen Oxford. This was my very first time, so that was one of the reasons, I would say. Mm-hmm. Plus, it's just amazingly beautiful.
It is amazingly beautiful. And then last year, you went to the rainforest.
Yes, Wartburg College is pretty amazing in that they have what we call field experiences for our students, and we have classes that go to Tanzania in Africa. A group just went to Namibia, another group went to South Africa. They take trips to Belize, they take trips to Malaysia, and I was fortunate enough to go with a group of faculty. I didn't teach a course this time, but with a group of faculty to Guyana. And we went to Georgetown and met with officials in the government there to talk about educational opportunities and talk to people at the University of Guyana. And then we went into the rainforest, which is really amazing because the economy of Guyana is traditionally based on things like, well, sugarcane, rice, gold, and they're rum exporters. And they have this amazing growing ecotourism business that is actually probably going to save a lot of the rainforest, and in addition will probably save a lot of the cultures that are out there as well. And it's an amazing place because when I talked to Roy about this, my other coworker, he was saying it's been close to only half a century since first contact with quote unquote like Europeans in some of these areas in Guyana. So it's still very, very much in some areas pristine, and it's just incredible to see giant river otters and parrots and toucans and everything just flying around, and it's once again incredibly beautiful.
Yes, it does sound excellently beautiful, and I hope it can stay that way. Well, John, one of the main reasons that I wanted to have you on this evening is because in my outreach doing this show, someone had said, really, you need to talk about this science and creation science, you know, creation science and the distinctions, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if you could take that on.
Oh, let's see. How can I take that on? I don't think that the word creation science should even be used as a word, because I don't think that creation science, as it is defined, is even a science.
Right.
And I have my own reasons for that. I think we can talk about creationism, and we can talk about a new type of what I would call quasi-science called intelligent design, and then evolution, or the theory of evolution, and distinguish between those three things. So I even would take umbrage at even calling creation science, because science is defined as those things, to most scientists anyway, as things that you can see, touch, hear, or measure. And then these things that we can see, touch, hear, or measure, these things that we can observe, if we have ideas on how they work, like really good ideas on how they work, say a theory, per se, on how something works, those theories have to be falsifiable. They have to be testable. We have to be able to find answers to them. We have to be able to test them and actually see, well, if we do a certain experiment and we get a certain answer, that answer, we have to be able to get an answer that can prove our hypothesis wrong. And there are certain things like trying to prove that God doesn't exist that you just can't do.
No.
You just can't. And most scientists, if you ask them, would say, and when most creationists would say, oh, scientists don't believe in God, you know, or they're godless, it's like, no, that's just not within the realm of science. I can't personally put God on the phone. I can't measure God. I can't, you know, I don't have a God meter. So as a scientist, it just doesn't belong in science. That doesn't mean that I can't believe in a spiritual power or anything like that. It just, for most of us, it means it doesn't belong in science.
Right, because they're ineffable experiences.
Mm-hmm. And creationism, I think, is just... Creationism in itself is sort of... I would like to describe it as more of a reactionary movement that doesn't want to accept a lot of the evidence that is out there for evolution, and wants to state that, oh, you know, the world is only 2,000 years old, and, you know, nothing could have evolved, and everything was just created in a series of days. That is, in essence, pure creationism.
Well, yes, I think that's bizarre, because Aristotle, who's way before Darwin, when you read him, to Aristotle, evolution is a priori. Things are changing. And I mean, he's not making categories, but he observes that things are changing over time.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that many indigenous people, like, you know, I feel that in the Chief Seattle speech.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's the consciousness by indigenous people that things are changing over time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just that Darwin happened to, you know, like, start the categories so that we can start, you know, making, creating a puzzle, you know, of how that all change worked over time, with, you know, how it did, giving names to things. But evolution isn't a new idea. And then wasn't there a gentleman named Wallace,
mm-hmm,
who discovered the theory, I mean, or didn't discover it, but who wrote about this theory of evolution at this, about the same time,
yes,
that Darwin did. But he came from the countryside. He came from the land. He wasn't a city, you know, a Victorian city person. And so when you read his work, there isn't this negative or this pejorative about, you know, lower, you know, about the primitives or...
But see, I think that in a lot of that work, if for Darwin or even Wallace, I mean, you have to put science in context of the culture in which it grew up in. I mean, it's like a lot of individuals, when I was taking psychology, they thought, well, Freud is just, you know, he's crazy. How could he be so obsessed with sex? And my response was, well, if you were, you know, a male or female in a Victorian era, and, you know, everything was completely covered and sex was completely taboo, I think you would come up with, you know, a theory about the human mind that probably revolved all around sex. And at that period of time, you have to understand that there was a lot of pervasive racism just in culture and society. And so for individuals, even Darwin, I mean, he's a product of society, to sort of think of maybe indigenous people as less, or, you know, not as evolved or whatever, which I don't think Darwin did. There were many people that came after Darwin that tried to phrase things in those terms, and they also tried to say, well, you know, women are also, you know, less evolved, and we can use evolution to show that eugenics is actually true, that some races are more evolved than others, which is completely erroneous and completely false. So I think you have to put some of that in context.
Right. Yeah, I was trying to say, well, Darwin came from this Victorian culture, so it stands to reason that he, you know, was such a pejorative picture of this lower and higher, you know, kind of the hierarchy in it all.
I think that there's some really great books out there and magazines. Natural History actually takes this whole issue on in November, the November issue of 2005, where they actually describe or show how Darwin actually described things evolving. And the whole idea of there being, you know, lesser than and greater than, that was something that really came up after Darwin's whole idea put forward, and it sort of was, you could almost argue it was a better marketing campaign. You know, if you think of humans on the top and they are the pinnacle of evolution looking down the evolutionary tree, it's much more palatable.
Uh-huh.
That doesn't mean it's accurate, and I don't think Darwin even thought it was accurate either.
Oh, well, that's good to know, John. That's very good to know. Now, mythology, psychology.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to take on that?
Take on mythology and psychology?
Yeah, like how, can you talk about how mythology and psychology work together?
Talk about how mythology and psychology work together. Oh, well, in a lot of ways, I think that perhaps modern-day psychology, I don't want to say modern-day psychology because a lot of modern-day psychology is actually neuroscience, which is actually becoming more of a science. And I have lots of friends that are psychologists. But I think in a way in our culture, and I don't mean this as any disrespect to my psychology friends or anything, that psychology in many ways, in some areas, is kind of replacing religion and mythology and is replacing that sort of spiritual element that people used to have in their lives. So I'm not sure what you're actually looking for there. I think that one of the problems that we have in our society today is, Karen Armstrong, we talked about this just really well in The Battle for God, is that there is this sort of divorce between logos, logical thinking, how the real world works, and mythos, which is sort of the spiritual world that we have and where we live in our culture in the last, since the Industrial Revolution and the Information Age, we are focused in an area of logos, critical thinking, science dominates, and a lot of people have lost that sort of spiritual side to themselves, and a lot of them, I think, have turned to psychology as a way to find that.
Right.
Were you looking for something else?
What was the name of the book?
Karen Armstrong, she's a religious scholar.
Uh-huh.
She's written many books.
Uh-huh.
The Battle for God is one, which talks about how when, I believe it's The Battle for God, there's so many that she's written, they're actually excellent, but they're really amazing because she talks about what happens to a culture when it faces, say, a scientific or a philosophical revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing because she talks about what happened to Christianity, what happened to Judaism, and what she would argue, I think, I don't want to put words in her mouth, is currently happening now to Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And that when the sort of new scheme or these new ideas emerge for how the world works that are at odds with the current mythos, the spiritual leanings of how we think the world works, there is a collision that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to come to some resolution at a later period, but these tend to be very violent times, very scary times, and times were not just violent and scary for cultures, but also as individuals. Like, where do I fit in the world? Is there an afterlife? What does that mean? How will I fit in? What do I do? Things like that. And I think that our culture is still dealing with that because it's only really been within this century that we are really dealing with these really heavy issues related to science, and trying to see, well, what does it mean that the human genome has been decoded? What does it mean that we now can, figure out how all of these things work? Is there any room for a spiritual life, for God, or anything like that?
Yes, yes, I hear that. I was thinking about mythology, how there are truths in mythology, but they're metaphoric truths.
Mm-hmm.
They're not scientific.
Yeah, they're not meant to be literal, but they still have tremendous meaning for a culture.
Yes, they still have tremendous meaning for a culture. That's where I wanted to go. They're not literal, though. They're not literal. And I was thinking about Arthur and Parzival and the Grail and Merlin saying to Arthur's half-sister, it's the end of the many gods.
Mm-hmm.
It's the time of the one God.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the end of the spirit of the trees and the rivers and the flowers.